started. Thank you so much for coming out this afternoon. My name is Heidi Schramm, no relation to John and Mary Schramm, former directors of Holden Village. Here at Holden, I work as a utilities assistant. But since 2005, I've also been working with an organization called the Christian Peacemaker Teams, or CPT. Much of the work that I've done has been support work, which I can do from here in the United States. But since 2005, I have traveled to the occupied Palestinian territories and Israel 5 times, living there pretty much consistently from the spring of 06 through the spring of 07. I've worked with CPP in a variety of capacities, but the one thing that has remained consistent for me throughout all these years is the importance of telling the stories of the Palestinians that I was so privileged to work alongside of for such a long time. So that's what I'd like to do today. This evening I'd like to do 3 things. I'm going to begin with a brief introduction to the Christian Peacemaker Teams, and then move on to an even briefer overview of the conflict between the Palestinians and Israelis. And I know that that sounds almost like an oxymoron, a quick overview of this conflict, but it will be brief, I promise. And then we'll spend the majority of our time talking about the nonviolent resistance movement in the tiny village of Atuan, Palestine. I also hope to have plenty of time for discussion and questions afterwards, which is always the most rewarding and interesting part of all of this for me. Feel free to interrupt me if you are lost, if I skip over things and you're not sure where we're headed. I might ask you to wait until the end or just trust me for a minute and we'll get to parts that resolve some of those questions. But do feel free to interrupt. So CPT began as a project of the historic peace churches. These include the Mennonites, the Quakers, and the Church of the Brethren. They're known as the peace churches because of the centrality of Christian pacifism to their doctrines. In 1984, at the Mennonite World Conference in Strasbourg, France, the American Mennonite minister Ron Sider asked the church leaders gathered before him to reconsider what it meant to claim the title Peace Church. He criticized the church for reducing pacifism to mere conscientious objection. True pacifism, he claimed, in the tradition of Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., and of course, Jesus of Nazareth, is active, it's messy, and above all, it's risky. He asked the church leaders to consider this question. What would happen if Christians devoted the same discipline and self-sacrifice to nonviolent peacemaking that armies devote to war? In 1986, some U.S. and Canadian representatives of these 3 churches met in Techney, Illinois, to begin to delve into this question and to lay the foundation for what would eventually become the Christian Peacemaker Teams. CPT's motto is getting in the way of violence. Our mission is to offer an organized, nonviolent alternative to war and other forms of lethal intergroup conflict. We do this by supporting indigenous nonviolent resistance movements in conflict zones around the world. How we do this varies based on the location and the particularities of each conflict in which we work. But all of our teams are engaged in some way in the documentation of human rights abuses and the unarmed accompaniment of vulnerable populations. As we get into the discussion of our work in Atuani, you'll begin to see exactly how some of these roles are filled. Right now, besides Palestine, CPT is active in Barranca Bermeja, Colombia, Iraqi Kurdistan, Grassy Narrows, Ontario, Canada, and the U.S.-Mexico border. In the past, we have also worked in Mexico, Chechnya, Kosovo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Haiti, the Philippines, the Bear Butte Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and I'm sure a few other places that I just can't remember at the moment. The history of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is complicated, to say the least. We are not going to go back to ancient history today, although we could. In fact, we're going to stick to mainly events that occurred after the year 1967. I find maps to be particularly helpful tools when we're trying to explain the core issues of this conflict. A few of you have already asked me if I have a copy of this map, so here it is. We're going to come back to it a couple of times. And because the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is essentially a conflict over land, this series of maps gives us a really good visual representation of how we got to where we are today. In each of these maps, the green territory represents Palestine, and the white represents Israel. before the founding of Israel in 1948, so we're looking at the first segment of this map here, you can see that small portions of Palestine were privately owned by Jewish immigrants or by Zionist or Jewish organizations. Europe, of course, was a hostile place for Jewish people at this time, and the Middle East was an extremely attractive option for immigration. Palestine and Iraq, in particular, were considered some of the most welcoming countries for Jews who were fleeing persecution in Europe. We're going to skip over the second image for now because the map never actually looked like this. This image shows the map as it was proposed by the United Nations, but it never came into being. And for our purposes this afternoon, I'm actually going to skip over the history of the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, though, of course, it was an important event for what we're talking about. The third map shows Israel in white and Palestine in green from Israel's establishment up until the year 1967. It is also very likely the map that you are most familiar with today. You may think that this is the current map from 1948 through now. But in actuality, the fourth map is far more accurate. I'm going to get into exactly why that is in a minute, and we'll come back to these images. In June of 1967, Israel was at war with Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan. Israel came away from that war in control of all of Palestine. That's the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the eastern part of the city of Jerusalem. Israel also came away in control of the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula and the Syrian Golan Heights. At that point, according to the international laws of war, Israel could have annexed that land. Israel could have doubled its size and expanded its borders. The green on our third map that we just saw a second ago could have become completely white, and Palestine could have ceased to exist. But annexing the conquered land also meant annexing the conquered people, and that was something that Israel could not afford to do. Israel, you'll recall, was founded in the wake of the Holocaust. It was founded as a Jewish state. If Israel were to grant citizenship to all of the people in the lands that it had acquired through this war, Israel would cease to be a Jewish state. Jews would be a minority in Israel. But for religious and security reasons, the government at that time did not believe that it could simply give the land back. While the government struggled with what to do about its Palestine problem, and that is official terminology in terms of U.S. policy, Palestine problem, it put into place a military occupation. Now, military occupation is completely legal under the international laws of war, but only for a set amount of time. The objective is to provide security while the state stabilizes. Take Iraq in 2003, for example. Saddam Hussein's government had been toppled, a new one had yet to come into power, and sectarian violence was on the rise. There was no way Iraq could have recovered from all of that on its own. Now, I am not making the claim that the occupation of Iraq was executed perfectly, nor am I claiming that Iraq is better off now than it was before the U.S. invasion in March of 2003. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the occupation was a necessary but temporary measure coming in the wake of horrific violence and the breakdown of a nation. It lasted 7 years, which is considered a long time. In Palestine, the occupation is now in its 44th year, because Israel has still not figured out what to do about its Palestine problem. Two generations of Palestinians have known absolutely nothing but occupation and captivity. Since 1967, many, many important events have taken place. An internationally backed political peace process began. It continues to this day in fits and starts. The Palestinian people launched two intifadas, or uprisings, which were grassroots movements aimed at expelling the Israeli military from the Palestinian territories. Both of these intifadas contained violent and nonviolent elements. The Israeli military laid siege to Palestinian cities, including Bethlehem and Ramallah. Palestinian extremists adopted suicide bombings as a tactic designed to force the Israeli government to change its policies. Israel responded by beginning construction on a massive wall separating Israel from the Palestinian territories and depriving Palestinians of land and the ability to move about freely. Israel adopted the policy of demolishing Palestinian homes as punishment for suspected terror activity or because they were built without proper permits. Palestinians elected Hamas as the ruling party in 2006. Israel began a comprehensive blockade of the Gaza Strip, utterly destroying its economy and forcing over 80% of its population below the poverty line. Israel invaded the Gaza Strip in the winter of 2008 and 2009, killing over 1,400 Palestinians in 22 days, the vast majority of whom were civilians. So this is some of the history, and we could talk at length about any of these things. But for the people of Atuani, the village where I work, the most important development since 1967 has been the establishment and expansion of Israeli settlements. I would also argue that this is the single most devastating policy in terms of the peace process, because as you can see in the fourth map, it has made the map so messy, and it really calls into question the idea that there can be two independent states living alongside one another, which of course is the basis of the negotiations. This last map is what Israel and Palestine look like today. The white areas that in the previous image are green are Israeli settlements. So the question I have for you is, how do we build an independent, viable Palestine out of those green splotches over there? So what is a settlement? A settlement is a community of Israeli civilians living in the Palestinian territories. While the Palestinians are subject to Israeli military law because of the occupation, the settlers living in the same area are subject to the far less stringent civil law because they are not treated any differently than Israelis living inside of Israel proper. This dual legal system in Palestine is what has given rise to comparisons between Palestine and South Africa under apartheid. It's not a perfect parallel, but I do think it's an important comparison to make. According to an Israeli organization called Peace Now, over 80% of all settlements are built on privately owned Palestinian land. That is land that we have documentation for. We can prove who the owners are, and they are Palestinian. While all settlements are illegal under international law, the Geneva Conventions, we can make a distinction between the different types of settlements that have sprung up in the Palestinian territories. Around Jerusalem, settlements are a lot like suburbs. They're huge. They are subsidized by the government, and most of these settlers move there because there are financial incentives to do so. Most are not settling for ideological or religious reasons. Why the government supports and encourages settlements is another story. It has to do with Jerusalem. It's something that we can talk about later on if you are interested in that. This is a picture of Har Homah, which is a large settlement outside the city of Jerusalem. Again, the people here are living in the settlement not for religious or ideological reasons for the most part. In rural areas, though, the situation is really different. Most of the settlers are there to claim the land of Israel for the Jewish people and believe that they have been ordered by God to do so. They are not afraid to harm or even kill any Palestinians who stand in their way. I should say that these settlers do not enjoy popular support in Israel. Polling evidence from within the country has shown time and time again that the average Israeli thinks these militant settlers are doing damage to Israel's image abroad and hampering the prospects for peace with the Palestinians. There are a handful of Israeli politicians who support them wholeheartedly, but most, including those who are right of center, admit that in a final peace agreement with the Palestinians, these settlements will have to be abandoned. In the meantime, however, the government, the police, and the military do nothing to rein these settlers in or to hold them accountable for their actions. They operate with total impunity. It's the second class of settlers that have found their way to the village of Atuani. Atuani is a small village in the region of the West Bank known as the South Hebron Hills. It's about 10 kilometers north of the Green Line being the Armistice Line from the 1948 war, which divides the Palestinian territories from Israel proper. It's home to about 150 Palestinians from four large family groups, so it's a very close-knit community. Through land registration documents first issued by the Ottoman Empire in the early 1500s, these families can trace their existence in the village back about 500 years. They've been here a really long time. The village itself has been around even longer than that. Its farmland is crisscrossed with roads that were built during the Roman Empire, and archaeologists have dated some of the caves in the village to the time of Herod the Great. These caves are still used by the residents today, mostly for storage, though in some of the surrounding villages, which are smaller than Tuwani, the caves still serve as surprisingly comfortable homes. Tuwani is an agricultural village. It produces mainly lentils, wheat, barley, and oats. The residents are subsistence farmers, meaning they only grow what they need for their own survival. They don't sell their crops outside of the village. They practice dry land farming. Water is scarce, and there is no irrigation system. But hundreds of years of farming knowledge passed down through the generations virtually ensures that enough food will always come out of the ground. Each family also raises sheep and goats, whose dairy products and wool are sold in nearby cities, and now provide the primary source of outside income for the village. While hunger is not necessarily an issue in Tuwani, the village is extremely poor. This was not always the case, though. Historically, the young adults and the village elders assumed most of the responsibility for the farming and shepherding, while men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s worked outside of the village, either in Israel or in larger Palestinian cities. The residents of Tuwani are highly educated, with most of the men possessing at least some college education. For years, Tuwani, in particular, had a reputation for producing skilled engineers whose services were in demand throughout Palestine and Israel. But since the start of the Second Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, 11 years ago now, Israeli restrictions on Palestinian movement make traveling to and from work nearly impossible. And a larger Palestinian society decimated by over 40 years of occupation can no longer afford to hire engineers. When there is work to be found, it's often unskilled labor paying very, very little. Few men work outside of the village today. This is the checkpoint outside of the city of Bethlehem. Under the Oslo Accords of 1993, this is the peace negotiation between Israel and Palestine brokered by the United States, the Palestinian territories were divided into three areas, areas A, B, and C. The division has to do with how power is shared between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Tuwani is in Area C. This means that Israel has total control over all security and civilian affairs, and total responsibility for providing for the basic needs of the Palestinians living there. However, Israel continues to refuse to connect Tuwani and its neighboring villages to any water supply, so residents rely on one spring-fed well for all of their drinking and cooking, and collect rainwater in cisterns for washing and watering the animals. Israeli authorities have repeatedly said that it's impossible to connect Tuwani to the water grid, but the Israeli settlement, one hill over, is connected and even has a swimming pool. You'll see in just a minute exactly how close the settlement and the village are to each other. In March of last year, the village and a team of lawyers specializing in humanitarian law scored a major victory when, for the very first time, Israel was connected to the electric grid. Prior to that, the entire time I was living there, the village had a huge and hugely inefficient diesel generator, which they ran for 1 to 3 hours a night, provided the families were able to scrape together enough money for fuel and maintenance. For the residents of Tuwani, the events of 1948 and 1967, that's the establishment of Israel and the beginning of the occupation, had relatively little impact. Isolated as it is from the major population centers, the village was largely able to continue to exist as it had for hundreds of years. Men working in the cities saw dramatic changes taking place there, but returned home to the village that they had always known. Change came to Tuwani as late as 1982, when the first Israeli settlers arrived. The Ma'on settlement, shown in this slide, began as an Israeli military outpost in 1981, when the military was looking at turning the entire South Hebron Hills region into a training camp. It was built on a hill confiscated from the Haraini family of Antwani. The plan for the training camp was scrapped the following year because they realized that people actually do live there. But the following year, instead of removing the trailers and mobile homes that they had erected and returning the land to the Haraini family, the military allowed Israeli settler civilians associated with a major Zionist youth movement to move in. These early settlers quickly began building permanent residence and cultivating the land, and the settlement grew both in terms of population and the amount of land it occupies. Today, Ma'on is home to about 400 settlers. The settlement occupies land owned by the Haranis and now as well as the Abu Jindia family of the neighboring village of Tuba. And as you can see in this picture, these are permanent homes. They're not going anywhere. The Haraini family was obviously not thrilled about losing their land, first to the military and then to these settlers, but they understood that they had no actual recourse. Appealing to the Israeli High Court is a long and costly procedure, and the court almost always rules in favor of the settlers anyway. So the Haranis decided to try to live alongside their new neighbors peacefully, farming and grazing their sheep on what remained of their agricultural land. But as the settlement began to expand, this became more and more difficult. In 1984, Fatima, the matriarch of the Haraini family shown in this picture, was out with the sheep when she was confronted by settlers who claimed that she was trespassing on settlement land. When she refused to leave, she was beaten. One settler fired a bullet into the flock of sheep, which drew the attention of her sons, who arrived on the scene to find their elderly mother on the ground, bleeding. Thankfully, the settlers were gone by the time her sons arrived. Her middle son, Hafiz, confesses that in that moment, he probably would have killed the settlers if he had had the opportunity. This is Hafiz, her son. The village gathered that night to discuss their options. Many wanted revenge, and at that time the people of Tuwani greatly outnumbered the settlers who were living just one hill away. But Hafiz, who was and is a respected village leader, asked them to consider another way. He talked to his friends and family that night about a growing nonviolent resistance movement that was gaining momentum in Jerusalem and other Palestinian cities. The argument he made was not a moral one. He was not attempting to convince the people of Tuwani that the lives of the settlers were as valuable as their own. Rather, he pointed out what they already knew. If they, as Palestinians, were to attack Israeli settlers, the Israeli military would respond quickly and with overwhelming force. Tuwani itself could be utterly destroyed and its people permanently displaced. Nonviolence for them was simply the smarter option. Initially, not everyone was convinced. Pacifism sounds a lot like passivism, and to many it seemed that Hafiz was suggesting that they all just stay quiet and let the settlers have their way. At the end of a long night, he had managed to coax promises out of the heads of each family that none of them would attack the settlement, at least for that night, and all agreed to continue the conversation over a longer period of time. Over the following weeks and months, Hafiz educated himself on the history and methods of nonviolent resistance. His ID did not permit him to visit Jerusalem, which was kind of the hub of this movement at the time. So the leaders of the movement met with him in Ramallah and Al-Khalil and other cities that he could access, and some even came to Tuwani itself. Eventually, most of the village was at least willing to give it a try, and the village council formally committed itself to nonviolence. For about 20 years, nonviolence in Tuwani simply meant remaining on the land when the settlers and soldiers demanded that they leave. Protests, nonviolent skills training session, and outreach to local and national media sources would all follow, but even today, this stubborn refusal to leave their ancestral home is the heart and soul of the movement. In the 1980s and 1990s, the people of Tuwani experienced beatings while working their land, terrifying nighttime raids on the village, and threats against their children's lives. And they bore it all alone. Even the nonviolent resistance movement in Jerusalem, which peaked in the late 1980s, was largely ignorant of the struggle taking place in the south. Tensions reached new heights in 1999 when one morning the residents of Tuwani woke up to find that a caravan of mobile homes had arrived in the middle of the night and taken over a huge, heavily wooded hill adjacent to the Ma'on settlement. The settlers called their new outpost Havat Ma'on. This expansion, though, was what finally caught the attention of the nonviolent resistance movement in Jerusalem, as well as, and perhaps more importantly, the Israeli peace movement. The Israeli peace movement has been in decline since the failure of the 1993 Oslo Accords, but is still very active in many parts of the occupied Palestinian territories. The establishment of this outpost also made it almost impossible for the children from the surrounding villages to attend school in Tuwani, having to walk past this settlement put them in grave danger. And I'm going to show a video now and let some of these kids speak for themselves about the work that they have done. This was in 2007, and it was a freelance journalist who put this together. I think he was from the Netherlands, but I can't remember for sure. So these are some of the kids that I have worked with.
For a school patrol, the children walking from the villages of Touba and Magair al-Abid come to school in Atwani with an Israeli military escort. Right now we are in between the settlement Ma'on and the outpost Havat Ma'on. So the children have to walk this road right in between two very hostile areas. So they walk with the military escort every day. When the escort was arranged, part of the agreement was that no internationals would walk with the children because international presence provokes settlers to violence. So we stand here and watch them each day. But when the children get to the top of the road here, they go around the trees, and for a few minutes we can't see them. And in general, that's when the attacks take place.
أنا هذه هناك حاجة حجارة مستويات الحين وقفنا قطبوا بين حجارة وبيضوا والحين رام علينا وصليضوا فينا وصليضوا في الجنة فديك دليل يمكن هي عينها كبيرة هي كرمت وهذه عينها
who's 7 years old from the village of Touba in Irim, and she about 6 months ago was attacked by settlers and hit with a rock in on her cheek right below her eye, and it has resulted in a bone infection that the doctors here haven't really been able to diagnose. So they got some money from the United Nations, from UN OCHA, and they're going to send her into Hebron to have an operation so they can do a bone scrape and figure out what kind of bacteria is growing there. But she's had chronic conjunctivitis and needs some serious work done.
Do you have any repercussions?
No, absolutely not. I don't know of settlers being arrested from these settlements, the settlement of the outposts here, ever.
شو اسمه؟ ما نعرف شيء. نعم. من مرحلة في
كده
11 سنة.
وفي مشوية مصابين.
احنا ما بنعرف فجأة بلاقونا فجأة.
شو
كده؟ هم يعني بيجونا وبصير يخافوا فينا. بدون شيء أنا بيجي الطريق.
بس
عبد الله ما احنا عربينا كمان بدون شيء يطلع الغنم فيه.
ايوه.
هم بحطوا للغنم سام وبيطبطوه وبيقتلوه.
Okay, so let's back up and give all of this a little bit more context. Besides the loss of a valuable piece of land, the major effect of this settlement expansion that took place in 1999 was to virtually cut off the villages of Tuba and Magaira Alabi from Tuwani. Tuba and Magaira Alabi are not shown in this photo, but they're just beyond Ma'on. And Tuwani is here, so you can see that they are blocking the way. Tuwani is home to the elementary school for the entire region, as well as the main road to the north to the rest of Palestine. So before the expansion, residents of Tuba and Magaira Alabid could reach Tuwani in about 45 minutes. And they would take this, they would take a middle path. Okay, so before Habat Ma'on, Ma'on was here. And so in order to stay far enough away from Ma'on, they would take this path that you can see snaking around the outside of the outpost to Tuwani. It took them about 45 minutes to reach there. After the expansion, in order to keep a safe distance from the settlement, the path they took closer to 3 hours on foot. It goes way, way, way down and then all the way around, and they would enter Tuwani from the back of the hill. Even then, they weren't safe. The hill on which Habat Ma'on sits is the highest in the region, which allows the settlers to watch the Palestinians walking back and forth between the villages. Attacks increased, especially on the school children, which makes sense if you think about it. The adults had pledged to remain on their land, and they had proven how stubborn they were. They were proven that they were willing to risk their lives in order to remain where they were. But what parent would risk her or his child's life? So this is the situation CPT was invited into the region to address. We began our exploratory work in early 2004 and had established a permanent presence there by the end of the year. Initially, our mandate was simple. Walk to Tuba in the morning, meet the children, walk with them to school, reverse the process in the afternoon, and spend the rest of the day in the fields with the shepherds and farmers. We walked the short path that passes between Ma'on and Habat Ma'on. We were encouraged to do this by Palestinians and by experts on some of these issues. Even though it looks like that's the most vulnerable path, it meant spending the least amount of time on the road. So they thought that that might be the safest. It was about 1 week before the first settler attack. Two CPTers, Kim and Chris, were severely beaten with sticks and rocks and chains. The settlers destroyed one of the video cameras and stole the other one. But their attack was focused on the internationals, and the children and the parents who had joined them were able to get away without physical harm. The team, along with the families who had children in school, reassessed the situation and decided to continue the school escort, but to move to this longer path that goes around the outside of Habat Ma'on, not the 3-hour path, but the 45-minute path. The second attack on internationals came 4 days later. Again, no Palestinians were injured, and this time the settlers focused all of their attention on an Italian man who was holding the video camera. After the second attack, the Israeli government got involved. The Knesset, which is the Israeli equivalent of Congress, called a meeting for the Committee for Children's Rights. The committee condemned the attacks and told Israeli and U.S. media outlets that these settlers do not represent the state of Israel. So the solution that they proposed was to have the Israeli military provide the Palestinian children with an escort. Nothing like this had ever been proposed before. And to this day, when I tell Palestinians about the situation in Tuwani, frankly, they don't believe me. There isn't a lot of faith in the Israeli military. Given the overwhelming preference by the military for settlers over Palestinians, they can't believe that Israeli soldiers would willingly protect Palestinian children from settlers. We, too, were skeptical and requested that we be allowed to accompany and document the escort. Our request was denied, the official reason being that our presence provokes settlers to violence. Nevertheless, the villages agreed to give the escort a try. So today, the role of the CPTR is to monitor the escort from a distance. By positioning ourselves on two different hills, we're able to watch most of the escort. Each day, we note the time the soldiers arrive. During the 2007-2008 school year, the children missed 25 hours of class because the soldiers so often arrive late. When they are late, we call the Army office and ask them to encourage the soldiers to hurry. Because soldiers are only stationed in this area for 3 weeks at a time, and they're essentially sent to a hill in the middle of nowhere whose only access roads are donkey trails, we spend a lot of time giving directions. Again, in the 2007-2008 school year, CPTers made 229 phone calls to the military because of problems with the escort. Even when the escort arrives on time, there are a variety of problems that may still arise. Some soldiers resent this part of their job and will drive in their jeep behind the children, sometimes fast enough to force the kids to run the whole way. And sometimes settlers attack anyway. That same school year, there were 14 incidents of settler violence against the children. Settler violence often takes the form of stone throwing and verbal threats, but I've witnessed children grabbed and pulled off the path into the settlement before the soldiers have had time to intervene. And on at least one occasion, the settlers released dogs into the group of kids as they walked to terrify and hurt them. Some of these soldiers are themselves settlers and do very little to stop the violence. Others are completely disgusted by the settlers and intervene very quickly. I've even seen soldiers bring cookies for the kids in the afternoon and offer them drinks of water out of their own canteens. But we never know. And I think that that insecurity actually makes the job harder and makes it scarier for the kids. One bright spot in all of this is that when we began the escort in 2004, three children from Touba and Magaira-Labib were attending school regularly. This school, we're averaging over 30. This school year, we're averaging over 30. School patrol brought us to Tuani, but the adults of the village are at just as great a risk of attack as are their children. This is Shahadi. In March of 2008, Shahadi was grazing his sheep when settlers attacked. Three of his sheep were shot, two of them fatally, and one of his goats was stolen. Although the incident was caught on tape, no arrests were made because the settlers had their faces covered with prayer shawls during the attack. This is a woman from the Shawahin family. She is sitting in front of what had been her family's entire lentil crop for that year. After weeks of harvesting, the lentils were heaped into piles to dry. She and her family woke the following morning to discover that these piles had been set on fire and the entire crop destroyed. You may remember that the people of this region are subsistence farmers, growing only what they need in order to survive. That year, the Shawahins went into debt, purchasing food from the city. On Christmas Day 2005, the Badi Rabai family woke to find that their olive trees had been chopped down in the night. The destruction of olive trees is a common tactic employed by settlers throughout the West Bank because olive oil is pressed and sold for profit, but also because of the symbolic importance of the olive tree to the Palestinian people. These trees are literally thousands of years old. They have suffered drought and war, and they continue to produce fruit. Palestinians draw strength from the endurance of their trees, and I have seen grown men weep over their destruction. In the summer of 2004, settlers dropped two dead chickens into Tuani's well, which, as I have mentioned, is its only source of drinking water. Oxfam International, an international aid organization, intervened in that case, paying for the well to be emptied, cleaned, and refilled with fresh water. In the spring of 2005, settlers spread poison-coated barley pellets throughout the fields in which Tuani's sheep and goats graze. 113 sheep and goats died as a result, and hundreds more were sick. But because there was no way to tell which of the surviving animals had been affected, which ones had ingested small amounts of poison, the entire milk supply for that year was considered contaminated and went to waste. Again, as I have mentioned, dairy products and wool are Tuani's only remaining source of outside income, so all of the families in the village went into debt that year to make ends meet. There are hundreds of stories that I could tell just like these. Most of these events take place at night when we're not able to document them, so no one is ever held accountable. And even when the documentation is solid, there is little hope for justice. Israel, as the occupying power, is the judge and jury in every case, and Israel is put in the awkward position of having to judge itself and find itself guilty of crimes against Palestinians when settlers attack. And that does not happen very often. As attacks and other acts of violence continue, I sometimes wonder what, if any, effect nonviolent resistance is having. But in those times, I of course turn to the Palestinians of Tuani and throughout the rest of the occupied territories for inspiration. I'm reminded that it would be easier for the residents of Tuani to abandon their homes, to flee the city, flee to the city, and to let the settlers win. The simple fact that Tuani still exists as a Palestinian village is a remarkable testament to the power of nonviolent resistance. And the movement is growing. With the assistance of CPT and other international and Israeli peace organizations, Nonviolent resistance in Tuwani and the South Hebron Hills has become more active and mature over the years. When settlers attack, villages respond with nonviolent protests that sometimes draw hundreds of supporters from throughout Palestine and Israel. For the last 3 years, at the beginning of the school year, the residents of Tuwani have staged a march to take back the road, where they all walk that short path between Ma'on and Havat Ma'on from Tuwani to Tuba and back. They believe that one day soon, these settlements will be gone and that road will once again be safe for them. For the last 4 years, CPTers have worked with the school teachers and parents to put together a school patrol report summarizing the successes and failures of the military escort, including some of those statistics that they keep track of. The residents of Tuwani host an annual release party for the report, inviting notables from the Palestinian, Israeli, and international communities, and delivering the report to representatives of the United Nations. The party includes the singing of traditional songs, folk dancing, and of course, because it's Palestine, a huge feast. It's a means of sharing Palestinian culture and reminding the world that that culture has not been crushed in Tuwani. The study of nonviolence has become a part of daily life in the village as well. A new museum of nonviolent resistance contains the writings of Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Gene Sharp, and others, all translated into Arabic, much of it for the very first time. Nonviolence is taught in the elementary schools, which I find to be amazing. Residents of Tuwani lead workshops in neighboring villages, recruiting new members to the movement, and they themselves attend conferences to further build their own skills. As political peace processes fail to deliver the promised results of a safe and secure Israel and a free Palestine, the people are forced to make their own way. In Tuwani, that way is nonviolence. It has worked before. In India, South Africa, Poland, Serbia, and other places, nonviolent grassroots movements have been instrumental in effecting political change at the highest levels. Given how deeply entrenched the systems of injustice in the occupied Palestinian territories are, it is certain that the people of Tuwani have a long road ahead of them. But by sharing their stories, by supporting their work and the work of CPT, we can help to make that road a little bit easier for them. I just want to open this up for discussion and questions. I know that was a lot of information to kind of throw out at you, but would you hit the lights, actually? The back switch, yeah. So we'll just open it up. It's, I think the dinner bell is probably about to ring, but it's only 4:45, so we can stay as long as you want. And we can also continue the discussion later individually.
Do the Palestinians recognize our role in supporting Israel in these things?
Yes, yes. The question was, do the Palestinians recognize the role played by the United States in the continuing of the occupation? And the answer is absolutely. After I left Palestine, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I worked as a lobbyist for a Palestinian rights organization for several years. And the reason I did this was because everywhere I went in the West Bank, I would meet Palestinians, they would ask me what on earth I was doing there. I would explain, and they would say, well, thank you, but don't you realize you're an American? If you went back to your country and changed your government, you would not have to be here doing this. You could come as a guest, you could come as a tourist. That's what we want from you. So yes, there is understanding of the role that the United States plays. If you're gonna be around on Wednesday, I'll be talking specifically about politics and particularly the role of the United States in all of this.
You ever get discouraged?
Yeah, I get discouraged a lot. And following the ups and downs, every time the peace process starts up again, everybody's excited, and we think something new is going to come out of this process, and we just keep getting the same results. For me, encouragement comes from talking with the people who are doing this work on the ground. And a lot of encouragement, I've drawn a lot of encouragement from the revolutions in the Arab states this winter and spring, and just the remarkable work that these people who are committed to nonviolence have been able to accomplish. It really, it gives me hope for Palestine. I don't know, sometimes I feel a little silly for getting my hopes up when things start to change or move a little bit in one direction or the other. But yeah, it's hard work, but it's something that I still remain committed to.
Is it all scary, or is there like some fun, or is it just all?
That's a great question. There is a lot of good in Palestine still, and I loved the time that I spent there. It was some of the scariest times of my life, but definitely the most rewarding. Weddings in Palestine last 5 days. It's 5 days of dancing and eating and just visiting and getting to know each other. That's so much fun. And the children, I mean, you saw them, they're embarking on this dangerous journey on their way to school, but they're playing beforehand. And so I would sit with these kids. Sometimes we'd sit there for hours waiting for the soldiers to show up, and we'd be playing. We'd be having a lot of fun. And participating in the protest work and the resistance work was really, really encouraging and really enjoyable for the most part, too. I think if there wasn't fun there, the Palestinians wouldn't be able to keep doing this either. So they're finding ways of making this enjoyable, and it's something that you can't help but enjoy doing. Yeah, I would much rather we didn't have to do it at all, but we enjoy ourselves at the same time. Yes?
Is it true? Go ahead. Is it, in your sense, is it true that the average Israeli citizen would just as soon see this thing get settled? It's only the extreme elements that are preventing any kind of a process from happening?
Yes, I think that is true. Where there is divergence is in what they see as ending this thing. Does that mean leaving a military presence in the Palestinian territories, like the Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying needs to happen for all of eternity? Or does it mean pulling out completely? Does it mean giving up the extremist settlements but keeping the bigger, more established ones? Does it mean giving up all of the settlements? All of these are questions that Israelis have differing viewpoints on. But the vast majority, they don't like living like this. A lot of work has been done on the Israeli psyche and on psychological problems of Israelis, because they are the occupier, and being the occupier puts them at risk for being cut down. And so some of this sometimes takes the form of terrorist attacks from within Palestine, but Israelis are always looking over their shoulders, I think. They're becoming more and more isolated internationally as well. And I don't know any Israelis who want to see all of this continue the way it has for so long. Yes?
I'm realizing I don't know as many facts about the whole situation as I thought I did. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that it was a mistake for the UN in 67 to make just an Israeli state, or perhaps they should have looked at all the people in that region and made more than one state?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the difficult thing about 1947 and the partition plan and the establishment of Israel was there were Arab people living everywhere in the Middle East. There wasn't land that you could carve out a state and say, okay, you can come here. A lot of historians suggest that because so many Arab states were so welcoming to the Jewish people, that there was maybe not necessarily the need for a Jewish state. That they could have lived as citizens of Iraq, of citizens of Jordan, citizens of Palestine, and been very safe. In the same way that the United States has robust Jewish communities, but we don't have a Jewish state within the Union. And I don't know. I mean, sometimes I feel like it's too late, you know, and we need to deal with what we have here. But I think it is important to think about how we got to where we are. And that is something that we'll talk about a little bit more on Wednesday if you're around for that. Yes?
This is, a related question, but because I can get my mind around these like small local struggles, like Tawani, like being able to keep the land you're on.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got, you know, both hillsides that are now covered with these new, you know, permanent settlements and things, and that the way that you showed that current day map, where the green is all sort of shrunken.
Mm-hmm.
Is there like a sense of, and you know, getting the U.S. you know, to change its policies, but is there a sense in Palestine of like what an end goal would be? Like, is it, I don't know, like, is it like if there's a unified thing that we're fighting for or not?
Yeah, I don't know how unified it is right now. part of that is Palestinian society is very fragmented politically, but most of the political fragmentation is because if you think back to the map, you have the West Bank and you have the Gaza Strip, and you can't get back and forth between the two without permission from Israel, which is extremely difficult to get. In the Gaza Strip, you tend to have people who are more in line with Hamas. Hamas is in control there. This doesn't mean that Gazans are terrorists. Hamas is more than a militant organization. It is a political party as well. In the West Bank, you have Palestinians who tend to align with Fatah, but there are pockets of Hamas supporters there as well. And there are more divisions than just Fatah and Hamas. I think in terms of final outcomes, Palestinians kind of fall into two main camps. They want the occupation to end. All of them want the occupation to end. And there are those who think that what that means is all of the settlements will be abandoned. Some may think that some of the settlements can stay, but will have some mutually agreed upon land swaps. So Israel will give up some of its land to Palestine and will redraw the map again in order for Israel to keep those settlements. But the military, the Israeli military, has to leave. Palestine does not have control over its borders, its land or its sea borders, and so they want control of the borders back. They want to be an autonomous, viable state. So the two-state solution is what it's called in political terms. The two-state solution is something that is definitely a mainstream position within Palestine. But the one-state solution is also starting to gain support. The one-state solution is calling for the removal of the Green Line, the removal of the borders between Israel and Palestine, and the establishment of one multinational state. Call it whatever you want. Call it Israelstein or Palriel or any of these things. Come up with something entirely different. But this is something that appeals to a lot of people on the left. Of course, Israel will never accept this, in my opinion, because that means giving up its Jewish identity, and it was founded to be a Jewish state. Whether or not we should have a Jewish state is an entirely different question that we can debate for a long time, and I don't even know where I fall in terms of the answer to that question. It's different at different times in my life. But yeah, so those are two of the solutions, I guess, that people are pursuing right now. The two-state solution is the policy of the United States. It's what we have been supposedly working towards since 1967, when we became the occupation.
Do you ever take your presentation on the road?
Yeah, I have done quite a bit of speaking when I was full-time with CPT. My visa would expire every 3 months because Israel would not give us work visas because they didn't like the work we were doing. So we were there on tourist visas. Every 3 months I had to leave, and I would generally come back to the States and go on a speaking tour.
Did you have any training before you went over there, and if so, what kind of training?
Extensive training. CPT has a long process for recruiting people. You begin by going on a delegation. CPT runs, I think, about 24 delegations each year to each of its different project sites. You spend 2 weeks, not so much with the team doing the work, but traveling around the area. So I went to Palestine, and I met with leaders of the Israeli peace movement, different Palestinian movements within the country, and just kind of got a sense of what's happening there, and then did spend a couple of days with the team as well to get a sense for what it is that CPT does. Once you have completed your delegation, then you can apply to go to training. Training is a month long. It's in Chicago. They do two trainings a year in July and January, and it is grueling that month. We would be up by about 5 o'clock in the morning, in bed around 10 o'clock at night. We worked 7 days a week. We had 2 days off the entire month that we were there. And a lot of the training in CPT, which I found to be strange at first, but now makes perfect sense to me, is interpersonal kind of conflict, how do we get along with each other type stuff. Because when you're in the field, you are living and working together. The house that I lived in, was about 20 square feet, and there were at least four of us living there at all times. We were together 24 hours a day. And so if you have conflict in the team, you cannot effectively work out in the field. This is, it's dangerous work, quite frankly, and you need to be able to trust the people that you have committed to doing this with. So we do a lot of that. We do a lot of history lessons as well for each of the project sites. Which was fascinating for me, not knowing much about Colombia, not knowing much about some of the other sites where we were working. And because we're a Christian organization, we did a lot of biblical training. We did a lot of Bible studies on the biblical basis of peacemaking. And again, because we're primarily out of this peace church tradition, the roots of Christian pacifism as well. Jesus as a pacifist and nonviolent activist. And then there were some, a lot of role-playing, a lot of scenarios. We would bring in current members of the Corps to talk about daily life on team and to share some of their stories. So a lot of it was kind of hands-on as well. But it was good training. And all of that, there's a process of mutual discernment happening all along the way. You meet with the personnel coordinator regularly. Every few days, are you sure this is right for you? Do you want to do this kind of work? And so they're really pushing you to make sure that you're committed to this. And in my training group, we started out with 12 and ended with, I think, 6. So a lot of people kind of weed themselves out of the process.
Are the people you were working with all Americans, or were there people from other countries?
No. Tuwani is actually a really interesting project for CBT in that it's a joint project with an Italian organization called Operation Dove. CBT had been working in the city of Al-Khalil, or Hebron, since 1993, and we began our work in Tuwani 11 years later. But we didn't have the staffing to start a whole new project. We were recruited by the Israeli peace movement. They suggested we go down and see what's happening in Tuwani, see if there would be the possibility of lending a hand there every once in a while. And then they put us in touch with Operation Dove, which had been working in a village called Abud, just outside the city of Ramallah. And together, between these two organizations, we thought we would have enough people to start a permanent presence in Tuwani. And it has worked out remarkably well. We are different organizations with very different backgrounds. Operation Dove is Catholic, but I think further removed from Catholicism than CPT is from its Christian identity. And so that has been very interesting for us. So we work with lots of people. And CBT itself is becoming more and more international as well. Our headquarters are officially in Chicago and Toronto, but we have representation from probably a dozen different countries now.
It's interesting. I mean, one of the things that it seems that most of the nonviolent movements have been successful, the reason they've been successful is because as much as the actual nonviolent protests themselves is the publicity that it generates.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, there's, you know, that's really what generates the pressure. So what are you folks doing? Because, I mean, I certainly wasn't aware of the level of this.
Yeah, that's been our biggest challenge, I think, getting these stories out. I mean, sharing them in a setting like this is great, but at the same time, I know I'm preaching to the choir.
Exactly,
in a lot of
yeah.
ways. And you don't get the invitations to speak before more hostile audiences, frankly. There's a really interesting documentary put out by the BBC called Peace Propaganda and the Promised Land. And it's kind of comparing news coverage of what's happening in the Middle East between here in the United States and in Europe in particular. And European media tells these stories. American media does not. Even in Israel, there is robust discussion and debate on what is happening about in the territories. Israelis know what is happening in Palestine much, much better than we do here in the States. You know, it's complicated, and I feel like when I start to really get into this, I run into so many conspiracy theorists, and I run into phrases like the Jewish-controlled media and things that I can't quite buy. I know that the Israel lobby, which again we're going to talk about a lot on Wednesday night, is very effective in silencing opposition voices. And ways that they do this, if an op-ed by a prominent person shows up in the New York Times and it's critical of Israeli policies or it's revealing what is happening in the Palestinian territories, the lobby and other pro-Israel groups in the United States can organize their people to write letters, to call the place of employment of the person who wrote this op-ed, especially if they're from a university, and try to get them kicked out. I mean, they can just mobilize their supporters so quickly and so efficiently that it becomes very, very difficult for anybody else, for any other voices to be heard. There has also been a lot of demonization of people who are pro-Palestine. I mean, President Jimmy Carter is oftentimes called anti-Semitic and a terrorist sympathizer. I mean, if you read his words, he is extremely moderate. And so the fact that he could be vilified in this way is really, it's really revealing of where we are right now as a nation in terms of our politics on this issue. I feel like there's more to it than that. I feel like there have to be more reasons why these stories aren't being told in the media. I can't blame everything on the Israel lobby, but I think that that has a lot to do with it. I also think that patterns like this are self-reinforcing, and this is where we are now. And so a couple of years ago, 60 Minutes ran a short clip on settler violence, and it was just a huge deal. And we, from my organization in D.C., tried to mobilize support for CBS because they were taking a hit from supporters of Israel. So there have been some attempts to try to tell these stories, but we have a long, long way to go on this.
And when you take this on the road and you meet those hostile crowds, mm-hmm. I mean, do they remain hostile?
Well, I haven't had very many opportunities to meet hostile crowds. I've met plenty of people who oppose my positions in Congress. I spent a lot of time on the Hill meeting with staffers of elected officials, and they're very respectful. They're politicians, and they work for politicians, and they very, very respectfully dismiss everything I say. And it's kind of, I feel like I'm banging my head against the wall when I'm talking to them. But I think that this is a very polarizing issue. And so one of the things that we would do with the lobbying organization was categorize the members of Congress as either already on our side, and so we can try to do things with them, like circulate a dear colleague letter or draft legislation. And then the people who are so far to the right, who are so entrenched in their positions as pro-Israel / anti-Palestine, that we're not going to waste our resources on them. But the vast majority fall somewhere in between. And so I would not intentionally seek out, you know, a Christian Zionist congregation, for example, and try to talk to them about this. Maybe for some person that is their calling, to go in and try to tell this story. But for me, I'm going to try to work with people who just maybe don't know very much about it. And in general, when I meet people who don't know much about what's going on, they're pretty easy to convince that at least something is happening here that I need to learn more about.
Well, you can come to Vermilion Community College in Ely.
Okay.
Official
great. Thank you.
Yes. Do you have any suggestions for how people could become involved in helping raise awareness or helping write congressmen? Or do you?
Yeah, definitely. There are some resource sheets up here on the fire ring that have a number of different organizations kind of broken down into different categories. And there are a few that are really good for advocacy. The one that I work for is the American Association for Palestinian Equal Rights, or APER, in Washington, D.C. And we do a lot of educational stuff and outreach in the community, and organize a lot of letter writing campaigns and organize a lot of meet with your representative days. We do congressional trainings. You can conference call with us and learn how to speak with your elected officials. Another organization doing a lot of similar stuff is the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation, which is pretty well known now, at least in D.C. and Chicago. And Churches for Middle East Peace is another organization. They're a little bit more moderate than I am sometimes, but they're a coalition of church leaders from primarily mainline Protestant denominations who are doing political work as well. The resource sheet also has information on organizations that are doing development work and other types of work in Palestine. And one way to support what's happening here is financially, giving money to people who are doing activist work on the ground. And so those are some options. But yes, there are a lot of great organizations to support in all of this.
Thank you.